You are all welcome without much ado. I will ask the minister to address us. Yes.
Chair, let me start with an apology. We had a meeting of heads of court on Sunday, following which, as a traditional, following which we started in earnest with the interview for the JSC on Monday, and the proceeding until Friday. So when I got an indication at around 4 yesterday that the parliamentary committee program had changed so that this presentation is done this morning as opposed to tomorrow, which was also going to be a problem for me because if I'm not at the JSC doesn't correct, so I have to physically be there or send a program. And I'm glad that the Deputy Minister Magwanishi once again has been kind enough to accept a short notice my request to represent me there when they were dealing with the filling of the two vacancies at the Supreme Court of Appeal. But nonetheless, I'll do the best I can. Other documents from other departments are still coming in as I'm busy addressing you. We'll do the best we can under the circumstances. let me start, Chairperson, by thanking you and the rest of the committee, as well as your counterparts in the NCOP, for the collegial and mutual supportive relationship that we've enjoyed since the start of the current administration and the current parliament. I really must express appreciation for that support, without which I don't think that, speaking for myself personally, I would have succeeded that much, so I continue to value this relationship. We work in an environment that is not entirely fashioned by our own actions or non-actions, but extrinsic factors play a significant role and influence everything from how we prioritize our work or different aspects of our work and how we respond. But we do not allow that to detract us from our overarching vision, which we draw from first our constitution, the National Development Plan, and of course, because we are there as government to prosecute the policies of the governing party, also the vision and the policy, overarching policy framework that the governing party naturally imposes, if you like, on us. So we are not an unguided missile. We are very much guided. Those are the frameworks within which we strive to achieve our objectives. Now, within that framework, there are a number of key, clear priorities that shape our vision. When we took office, for example, you'd recall that the NDP envisages a South Africa where the people of this country are not only free, but actually safe, but actually feel safe. And that is one of the critical objectives or outcomes that talks to much of what we do in the justice portfolio. And this is to achieve through refining the way in which our justice system works, by striving to identify, amongst other things, the weaknesses in the system, the weak links, and with a view eventually to restore public confidence in the system, because ultimately it has to be a justice system that firstly all our people feel a sense of ownership of, feel that it is a system that is responsive where they need it most, and a system that can protect them. Now, very often we tend to focus when we talk about, on a topic like this, on the criminal justice component of the system. Very often we forget that equally important, we have to talk about the civil aspect of the justice system. Why is it so important that we need to focus on both legs of that system? My proposition is this. A social and economic order cannot thrive in any country without being underpinned by a sense of security amongst the larger majority of the people of that country. And that talks to confidence in the criminal justice system. But equally, for that same social and economic order to thrive, you need a justice system that will be able to support the vision of achieving social and economic prosperity that's inclusive, and where the citizens feel that their socioeconomic rights will be protected. Now, over time, there has been a degeneration in the ability of our justice system to achieve the latter objective. We very often focus on the criminal aspect. We can talk about how the ordinary communities out there bemoan the fact of dangerous criminals being set free shortly after arrest, on bail because there is insufficient evidence to prosecute them. Circumstances that communities feel that the justice system is not responsive enough to come to their aid when they need it most. And to that end, we have said the different components of that system need to come together and fashion a program that would turn around the system in a manner that we identify and eliminate this gap, as I said earlier, so that we maximize convictions where convictions are due, but on the same breath, we maximize acquittals where acquittals are due. Because justice is not just about convictions, it's also about acquitting the innocent. It's also about protecting the children. It's about protecting women. And to that extent, for example, you'd recall that in 2013, we reversed the policy that sought to do away with the justice system having a dedicated focus on protection of women and children, because the concept was justice is justice is justice, policing is policing is policing, regardless of what the issue is. And we said we need to go back to identifying the most vulnerable in our society and bring about special measures to protect them. And that gave rise to the launch of the special sexual offences courts that we've since been rolling out. And coupled with them has been the rolling out of the Tuzela Centres on Justice Society, which are one-stop service centres where victims of sexual violence, for example, can get ED and immediate both medical attention attention, as well as justice intervention, if you like, that is in an integrated manner. So you get into a Tutuzela center, quickly get examined, have access to prophylactic treatment within the 72-hour period, facts and other evidential material as taken in time, the specialized people there who are specially trained in the handling, in the proper handling of the evidence. If it's children who are victims, the court proceedings are designed in a manner and the facilities are therein that is conducive for child witnesses, including the use of what do you call those facilitators in touch court proceedings. Those are some of the examples of how we have driven to respond to this call in the NDP that says women and children must be able to walk the streets, walk the parks during the day and feel that they can be safe in South Africa. But we still have a long way to go. And we have to work our way backwards to say between 2030 and today, what are the low-hanging fruits of matters that can make a difference immediately? But what are the medium to long-term interventions as well? And we have to do this in an integrated way. Integrated way how? What are the tools that will facilitate an integrated response to giving implementation to that vision of an integrated criminal justice system, talking about that aspect of the system? I'm sure at some point you got a presentation on the IJS project, for example, where automation is used as a tool and platform to bring together, I think there's six key strategic partners in that project: corrections, police, social development, prosecuting authority, etc., all of whom are meant to create portals in the system which will be poised to receive and transmit data across the criminal justice system in a manner that creates a transversal, seamless and automated system of managing our criminal justice system. Now, there have been a number of issues, and I know the chairperson is particularly passionate about this, which provide a special focus in the process of the reforms that we try to achieve. The traditional courts has been a whole point for some time. I had meetings with, consultative meetings with the leadership within that sector, for example, to try and expedite finalization of the difficult issues underpinning the work that needs to be accomplished in ultimately reforming that segment of our justice system. Some of the sentiments I expressed, of course, is that my take of the Constitution and what it enjoins us to do is to ultimately achieve a truly integrated justice system in South Africa, where the different cultures, the different histories, the different knowledge systems that are drawn from the different components of our society can find expression in a single integrated justice system, so that there isn't a different justice system for different sections of our population. if we're going to continue as has been the past tweet of rural justice, if you like, or indigenous justice, as has been developed the justice system, we continue to perpetuate inequalities in our society. I believe, for example, that the common law system that has sessioned and shaped our mainstream, if you like, justice system, but the customary law system of the Romans and subsequently of the Dutch have discarded it and codified their legal system, so they don't follow their common law anymore. But historically, we are one of the countries which are trying to make up two-thirds of the world that still follow that system. But I believe that it can be enriched and embellished by many legal principles that you can derive from indigenous customary law. And I have a professor here called the chairperson of the committee who should be writing a book about this. So I think there's a lot that can be done. The issue of language in courts, how do we make sure that not at all litigants, first and foremost, put aside their legal representatives, feel that they can relate to court proceedings, because the language and the languages that are used in court make them feel that they are part of the proceedings, and that the proceedings are not about them without them. In the disability rights movement, we have a slogan, "Nothing about us without us." Because the justice system ultimately must be inclusive rather than exclusive. And that also talks to issues of access to justice, both in terms of financial access. I must say that legal aid over the past decade or more has done quite a bit in transforming itself with a view to ensuring that ultimately every South African, first in the criminal space, has access to justice by having a qualified and competent legal representative to stand in for them, to stand for them, to defend them when they are accused in criminal proceedings. But there has been a gradual expansion of the civil component in the role of legal aid to ensure that civil justice is not overlooked, especially when you talk of the poor, who equally, even in civil matters, deserve different legal representation but very often cannot afford it. And as a result, their houses can be repossessed or dispossessed and so on. There's a lot of social and economic injustice which our justice system has not reached a point where we can say we are able to deliver justice. And that's an area. And hence, for example, not so long ago, we had to come to you and propose legislative reforms following certain litigation to deal with the management of things like garnishee orders, things like default judgments and summary judgments, which are tools that are used by banks and insurers and others. The borrower money to be told that they can pay back, and before you know it, they dispose of some of their basic belongings and everything else with very little support to defend their rights. South Africa, is my understanding, is increasingly becoming a heavily indebted society. So you can imagine how busy our courts are in this regard. Now, of course, the tools to achieve this, to achieve this justice for all concept, this justice system that every South African will have confidence in to my country. And in the face of prevailing economic circumstances, there's only so much that you can do. So what we do need to do is to look at what our priorities are, where our inefficiencies are, and how do we specifically target resources that can be redirected in a manner that we support that which we regard as our priority, and of course control spending in areas that we can make some sacrifices. And I must say in this regard, in my meeting with Heads of Court on Sunday, I was pleased because, you know, the Constitution says that as part of the Fundamental Clause, we cannot touch judges' benefits or conditions of service. So for the judiciary to say to us that they're buying into austerity, they'll curtail value of cars that they're going to drive, like the executive has committed itself, cost of hotels this day, and I don't know what could happen, salaries increases in the next year or two. I will not touch that, it's not my problem. And of course, in the face of that, we have a situation where the law judiciary, which presents an even bigger challenge, because remember, before 1994, they were public servants. Post 1994, and the current constitutional dispensation, they are a segment or component, and an important one at that, of a single judiciary in South Africa. That's what they have become. How do we ensure that their conditions of service are such that mirrors the new identity in the face of austerity? Those are issues which I'm sure the CFO and the DG at an opportune time might be able to share with us where they think they can create the space. But we agreed with the Deputy Minister that I'm going to, as part of the delegation of the lower judiciary issues to him, he is leading a task team that includes representation for the lower judiciary itself to review their conditions of service and shift it from the current arrangement where it is currently being dealt with administratively within the Department of Justice, ahead of course eventually of replacing the current Magistrates Act, which is the 1954 Act, with the new order in similar manner as we did with the Superior Court Act after the 17th Constitutional Amendment Act, to basically reorganize the lower judiciary and to reintegrate it into a single judiciary, as I said earlier, under the leadership of the Chief Justice, which is where we are ultimately going. It would call that, and I'm just trying to cover as much as I can different critical areas. There's a lot of narrative that's introduced here, which would take me 4 hours to read out, so I'm trying to avoid doing that because of limited time. And feel free, if I leave out areas that you have particular interest in, that we can go into. But just to complete that point, we envisage to come with a new dispensation by way of a bill of the magnitude that the Superior Court Act was, to basically reorganize a lower judiciary to integrate it into a single judicial order under the leadership of the Chief Justice and the respective head of courts of the various divisions of our High Court. The current arrangement, just a recap, you recall that the effect of the 17th Amendment and the Superior Court Act was to firmly confirm the judiciary's leadership role of the courts, and in particular defining their mandate properly as the ultimate managers, as the captains of our courts, and went further to provide a dedicated administrative support system to them to enable them to discharge that constitutional and statutory mandate through the OCJ, which now exists as a separate vote. What number is it? Is it vote number what? 22 become 40th vote, I think. Is it the 40th vote? The last new baby in this table. Now, a lot of work has since been done to separate out the two administrations, or rather that administration that the OCJ represents, of course, out of the rest of the justice portfolio and vote. And it's been a gradual process. It's involved mutual cooperation between the two departments, the two accounting officers. There is a matter which was also the subject, you'd recall, last year of a summit that the President convened between the judiciary and the executive to deal with a number of issues relating to the relationships between the two. And one of them that is still an ongoing engagement relates to the notion of the extent to which the judiciary can take charge of the actual administration of the resources designated, delineated to support courts, as opposed to the current arrangement where that responsibility still resides with us. So the OCJ, as an office, as the administrative board, remains our executive responsibility. But its sole purpose is to support the judiciary in the discharge of the judicial functions under the Constitution and the prescriptive value that to earlier. So there are those ongoing conversations around this matter, and I do not want to preempt or even open up the debate, because there's two sides to that story. But I'm sure due course, when this matter has settled, you should be in a position to take into confidence as to what the final policy position becomes, and we may even, if need be approaching ourselves as a collective across political lines if constitutional amendments may become necessary, in the same way as the 17th Amendment became necessary. Now, I alluded to the fact of the tools that you require to achieve the kind of policy goals that I alluded to. And that includes, amongst others, your infrastructure, because we touched on the issue of austerity and limited resources, as in actual financial resources, that are currently available. And that dictates the extent to which and the speed at which we can introduce some of the creative ideas that we have in mind. The human resource issues need to be managed in a particular way, and there are constraints there. In the 2007-08 period, for example, government took a policy position that introduced an occupational specific dispensation that was to achieve the goals of promoting creating incentives for professionals with high-end skills to find the public service attractive, whilst at the same time those that are already in it should find it attractive to stay. But it's had its own challenges. It's had its own financial implications. It has its own drawbacks. And that is one of the challenges that continue to bedevil our effort to stabilize and improve our human resource tool as a critical tool to achieve our political or policy objectives. For example, if you take this bill attorney's office, everybody complains that there's a lot of inefficiency and so on. One attorney at any given time is settled with something like 600 files. God knows, I don't know how they even get to know what's in those files, because some of them are very big, you have to go through all the documentation and so on. With the result that there are a lot of lapses that happen there. So that in the face of OSB, there's been a kind of a bubble that's been created between the top segment and the bottom segment. If your middle field is not strong enough, what happens to you? So we have those challenges. And so reorganizing the state of Jenny's office from an HR perspective is a critical objective on our side. We need to address the issue of leadership at the helm of the state attorney's office. You'd recall that your last amendment to the State Attorney's Act sought to resolve the issue of leadership of that organization, but unfortunately the Solicitor General that was created as head of that institution must be appointed under the Public Service Act, which means they cannot go beyond a DG's position. And in fact, what happened was that the department did a work study, I'm using old language, I don't know what they call it these days, and located that position at the DG level. Now, it's been advertised, I must get from Justice HR, where we are in terms of the quality of applications we could. But I'm a bit skeptical that we will be able to attract quality we require of leadership that can really turn around the state of tennis office, because the state is really bleeding in some instances unnecessarily because of inefficiencies at varied levels in the state litigation account. It varies from administrative lapses to sometimes the quality of counsel that we engage, the quality of preparation, the role that our client departments play in ensuring that the briefs and the instructions that are issued relate to matters that are defendable, so that we maximize the prospect of success in court. Of course, some issues we just can't avoid. Even if the risk of losing is very high, there's just too much at stake. So. But we do need to consolidate the state litigation account, if possible, across all three spheres of government, including SOEs and so on. Why? Because the state litigation account is a critical tool, firstly, that can help us achieve transformation in the profession by ensuring that the distribution of work is such that it facilitates inclusion, including gender and racial inclusion. But at the same time, we need a strong state litigation account that will enable us to win cases of the state as well. In deserving cases, of course, people that have legitimate claims, they should win against the state, I believe. But we lose a lot of cases unnecessarily, so we need to address that. The efficiencies that need to occur in the justice so that we can maximize our objectives depend on these things being stressed. And to that extent, in my engagement with management, we are looking at concrete efforts that we are making to turn around the system. But there's also such other work as, for example, under the new Legal Practice Act, we have established now the Legal Practice Forum. It started its work, it gave us its first report, which focused on them organizing themselves for the work, and we've just received a second report, I understand, early May, they will be presenting it to me so that I get a sense of what it is in the interim that they're proposing to do or that we do to deal with some of the immediate challenges that confront the profession. Obviously, the issue of transmission will come up, but there are many other issues. Issues of the cost of litigation has been a subject of a sore point in our society. So stabilizing that environment is crucial. And hopefully in the process, stamping out abuses as well in the profession. We've heard of many cases with MVA cases, people being fugitives of the law, prisoners. And then the issue of protecting the poor. Because I can tell you, this government has invested so much over the past 2 decades in the poor. And yet, for every cent that we're holding, somebody out there in the dark is lurking to see how much of that cent they can appropriate to themselves. So we do need to protect the little gains that the poor have acquired through our socio-economic policy interventions as the justice system. It's part of our mandate, and we shouldn't underestimate its role, because that way we will be supporting the socio-economic and developmental goals of the country. We cannot say that ours is to keep people safe for them. We have to support transformation of the economy, radical economy, transformation as it's called. There are a number of things, some of which I've alluded to. But in the context of our own internal processes, we have to make sure that we constantly monitor that no less than 2% of people employed are disabled. We have to make sure that they achieve the goal of at least 50% of our complement being women. We have to ensure that in procurement processes, of course, we promote team governance, but at the same time, we promote black economic empowerment. The business of the economic cluster only. We have to ensure that we create spaces for young people to get opportunities in our government, respective government departments, through internships and other support systems. We need to transform the profession to get it inclusive. In this province, at the KEPA, out of the over 400 advocates that are there, I'm told less than 20 are African. This is 20 years into democracy. How did we end up here? What is it that is preventing young people, young African male and men and women, from being attracted to join the KEPA? People tell me they're not getting work, and it's all blamed on the state of MS office. And I say, and as much as I say to the JSC, it can't just be about us as government, it has to be a partnership. White Senior Council must be prepared to take along African male and female young emerging lawyers under their tutelage if we're going to achieve transformation. So that real skills transfer takes place. Right. Some of the major capital projects that we have embarked upon since democracy was to ensure that on average we build 2 courts a year, mainly in the lower judiciary. And this has also been aligned to our other objective of rationalizing the entire magistrates' court, the boundaries to geographical boundaries of magistrates' courts, as much as possible to mirror the geographical boundaries of our municipal dispensation, which itself has been shifting, as you know, in another context. So we have to constantly strive to adapt so that we have synchrony between political boundaries or administration boundaries of municipalities of provinces coinciding with our own boundaries as justice, and hence one of our big achievements is to ensure, in line with the Superior Courts Act, that every province in South Africa has a high court. The Limpopo High Court commenced in earnest at the start of the first term this year. I think it was the 25th or 27th of January. We all went there to witness that all the systems are in place, the prosecuting authority is ready, legal aid is ready, there's accommodation for everybody. And in October last year, we even went so far as to launch a new bar for that province. Advocate Mukari leading it. You'd recall he featured in the Albuquerque matter last year. And what we researched there is the launch of a thriving new legal profession, both the bar and side bar, a full-fledged bench. Currently we have I've done acting appointments for judges to constitute the first batch, and eventually the intention is for the president to confirm them by way of transfer. 3 of the judges coming from Gauteng and 1 from KZN, because we wanted to make sure that from day one there is capacity in that court to deal with all manner of cases. So we brought in experienced judges to help start the court. The NPA brought the head, the provincial head from the Northern Cape, I forgot her name, who has relocated to her home ground, and she brings about, I think, 20 years of experience at senior level and so on. So we wanted to make sure that the court is a success from day one. We'll be doing the same thing with Mpumalanga. So eventually we'll have a complement of, I think, 7 judges plus the head of the court. The judge president was appointed last year to the JSC, recommended him, Judge Mahola. And there is a vacancy that's pending filling for BJP there. We, in line with the Superior Courts Act, are introducing 2 critical interventions to strengthen the capacity of courts, of higher courts, and to maximize access. One is to make sure that every high court has at least 1 DJP, deputy judge president. Some cases you have more than one, like Eastern Cape, for example. You have 2 DJPs, one who has recently been appointed not so long ago, that of course there was some controversy around certain issues which I'm not going to, but the president is appointed and the matter is settled. The local seat that has been created for the first time, Bishop Tata and DDP, to ensure that given the vastness of the province, people in Tata, in Bishop surrounding areas, do not have to travel to Grenfell to get Tata. Now, in similar vein,
sorry, Minister, you will have to drive me.
All right. I haven't even touched questions yet. Three different votes, each of which require a dedicated discussion. So we're trying to compress all of that in one, which is a bit of a challenge. And they've given me very big inputs for each, which would require 2 hours each to present, unfortunately. So I'm trying to pick and choose issues. Maybe let me at this time to just leave the justice narrative altogether, and maybe one day I'll tell you more about the rounds that we did at all the high courts, meeting all the judges, and practically meeting the leadership of each of the courts to understand the challenges that confront them, and some of the interventions have already been taken to bring relief in meeting. But we have media to learn some intervention that we agreed on, which hopefully will help improve issues like security in court, infrastructure that has been generating, cleanliness of court, and all those issues. But that's a discussion for another day, perhaps. Corrections. I was put on the spot a few weeks ago at Scopa, where I was asked to talk to 3 or 4 key areas. Infrastructure, HR, and what was the third one? ICT, and the use of consultants and contractors, given the various reports, not only in relation to corrections, but across government by the Auditor General in the past, about relying too much on contractors and so on, where we subcontract just about everything, including things that we should be doing ourselves and developing the capacity to do internally and improve efficient use of our limited resources. Now, and I haven't touched on some of the specific projects at justice that have started unfolding, and with the timelines that we envisage around building a court and so on and so on. But with regard to corrections, first touching on the issue of well, maybe let me just start with the vision. You'd recall that post-94, we've decided that we no longer run a prison system, we run a correctional services system. And that has necessitated legislative and policy reforms. There's been a white paper, there's the 1998 Corrections Act, there's the new remand dispensation. We are currently working on, because by the way, 2 days into office, I was confronted with a court order that required me in 30 days to decide on the parole of a certain high-profile offender, Eugene de Kock. Subsequent to that, we got very busy with the parole system. And in the process, we identified a lot of inefficiencies, inadequate alignment between legislation and then other prescripts on the one hand, and the administration of our parole system. So we have embarked on a process to review the parole system. I'm told that there's a document that should be on my desk that I can look at, that touches on different aspects. And new ideas around how we can reorganize our parole system. You know that tomorrow the our appeal is coming in on the matter of the Janus case, which is out of the works in our effort to manage the parole system in a particular way. So we're constantly challenged every step of the way. Through litigation, South Africa has become a highly litigious society, as you know. But even within that, we think there is much room where we can begin to reorganize the policy framework of any parole, the institutional arrangements, the parole boards, criteria that we use to appoint people onto those boards. The NCCF, we appointed an interim NCCF, although legally we can call it interim for a year, because we wanted them to focus on assisting in redesigning the parole system. And they've contributed enormously to that. So they due for the NCCS is due for reappointment in the sense of a new NCCS being appointed by the end of May, I think. So to engage you early on, Chair, to avoid the mishap that happened in the last round where we skip an important critical aspect, and that is consulting you properly in establishing that NCCS, making sure that this time around we do not flout the rules in that regard. The focus that we want to shift from is one which is too much inward looking up on incarceration. What happens to offenders in our prison, which is our core mandate in our correctional facilities, to focus where corrections is seen as a facilitator in the attainment of NDP vision. Every South African is so safe. We want to strengthen our partnership out in communities, targeting young people who are always the bigger interest group when it comes to offending behavior with all the problems of substance abuse in our communities, violent crime mainly associated with youth, and issues of youth unemployment being a critical factor that spurs this situation, where we firstly ensure that our young people and all our attendees, when they come out, they have the necessary skills for easy reintegration. Some of them have said, but why do you continue to burden us with this criminal records? Because we can't get jobs, they ask for criminal records, and then nobody wants to employ us. And I'm just indicating that there's nothing in law that prevents a person with a criminal record from being employed, except employment in specific areas relating to specific offences. Obviously, you don't want somebody who has distinguished themselves as a fraud star in your account division, because lots of prayer faith and lead us not into temptation. So, but we think that society really needs to open up to our people. I mean, we have achieved rates in the order of 96% compliance with parole conditions, for example, with our parole system, which is an outcome and an indicator of significant improvement in reducing offending behavior, at least with the parole system, because those that are on parole are still under supervision and we're able to supervise their behavior outside our correctional facilities. And if they move behavior, bring them back. Because parole is a privilege, really. It's not an automatic right. We want partnerships even beyond taking care of our own inmates when they leave, but also partnership in with those that are there to promote social development in society, targeting young people, etc. Because we have certain capacities that we can share in terms of our own agricultural production lines, which are aimed at promoting self-sufficiency, for example, for ourselves to be able to produce and grow our own food and not have to buy everything. We can share some of the capacity with surrounding communities who are economically deprived, targeting young people through sharing skills. And so there's been very successful partnerships in those regards. Country, the arts, and a whole lot of other areas of skills that can be shared. Even though the skills primarily are targeted at strengthening the skill sets amongst our own inmates so that when they leave, they are in a position to survive out there. In the past, corrections used to build their own infrastructure. You had engineers and planners and everybody else. That capacity over time has been diminished with a shift in policy where public work does everything for you. And of course, we've had our own challenges. And in the face of austerity, we're going to have to go back to some of these things. And I intend to drive a policy thrust and push my colleague, Minister of Public Works, to accept that we allow gradually to restore that capacity, because that would also elevate the quality of skills that our inmates have in plumbing, electrical, and all sorts of things that can come in handy when they leave our facilities to fend for themselves out there. ICT, I thought of the integrated justice system. Now, corrections is a component of that system. The department issued through the procurement process a tender around towards the end of last year to procure what they call the integrated the inmate management system, in which will create a transversal, truly automated inmate management system in South Africa, where in circumstances where currently each of the 143 facilities, correction facilities, is a silo, is a standalone with their own, what do you call those divisions? Servers. Each one has its own server that is self-contained, so the information is there. It gets sent to a central location as historical information, not as a real-time single screen system where whether you're in the Eastern Cape or the Western Cape or any other Cape, you punch into a computer in real time, that information is immediately accessible anywhere else in the country. It's immediately accessible to justice, to police, to whoever, in the same way as what they punch as police, that information is immediately available to all the other partners, so that the efficient management of inmate information, accused information, convicted person information is captured in a single, I'm not a computer guru, so I don't know what the language they use, but I'm sure a fellow politicians do understand what I'm talking about.
Minister, I've already given you 10 more minutes.
Okay.
What we do?
I can say, Chair, is that given my time, this narrative, you shouldn't worry too much about all my waffling and so on, because the experts are available. They can give you dedicated briefings on any of these things. The three accounting officers, you can schedule them with their support teams from their respective administration, and then you can get a much more intelligent story than mine. But feel free to engage me on any aspect that you would particularly want to focus on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. Before I open the floor, I just want to make the following observation. You have said that there is a degeneration in the administration of justice, and I want to agree with you. And you have also said that the social economic injustices make it difficult for us to deliver justice to our people. In fact, when the President addressed the Parliament last time, he said that every department should do something radically different to make sure that we turn the situation around. Now my question is, how do you expect that we can actually deliver justice to the majority of the people in this country when the majority is still trapped in informal settlements where there are no access roads for police vehicles, there are no access roads for ambulances, there are no addresses. How do you then deliver justice to people in such a situation? And also, it appears that the focus in the justice system seems to want to address the needs of the first world, not the second world. Because if you take these informal settlements, unless the communities are empowered to police and judge themselves, I don't think there's any way where we can go. And my problem is when we look at the record of this Parliament, for the past 15 years, there has been an attempt to come up with a community court legislation, which would be better placed to address the challenges in these areas. But the department has not been, it's not under your watch, even before you. The department is not able to make progress on the establishment of community courts. We have a community policy. It doesn't seem that those structures are functional as we stand. And then we had advice centers in the past. There has been calls for paralegals. And now we make the introduction of laws on paralegals, dependent on lawyers, practicing lawyers, who are business people who feel threatened by the paralegal practice, which should not threaten them. And then the department has allowed for the Foundation for Human Rights to administer funds which could be used to promote and establish structures for community justice. And you look at the board of the Foundation for Human Rights, it's not representative of the people that need those services. Isn't it time now to relook at the composition of the board for the Foundation of Human Rights and also change the mandate of that board and make it more representative? Secondly, the integrated criminal justice system. I think that government departments are working in silos. No department knows what the others are doing. And I think you should, time permitting, or at some other point, tell us more. Does this integrated justice system, something that exists in the papers or government documents, or is it something that is real, that is happening or on the ground? My view is really that this integrated justice system is a story, and maybe we need to come together with all the departments that are involved, and we should even involve home affairs, housing, and really start to talk and make things tangible. The other issue, Minister, is that our justice system is very technical. It's formal, not substantive. And we need to begin to indigenize the legal system, because the majority of the people can access this modern legal system. The language is a barrier, and now the introduction of indigenous languages in the universities has been farmed out to the universities. So the universities and the lawyers who are business people are dictating the pace of change. And I think that that really has got to change. The department must take charge of the pace of transformation and not leave it out. But also, you know, we talk too much about human rights. But, you know, human rights are also contextual. In Africa, we talk about human and people's rights. But in this country, there is an overemphasis of individual or human rights, with the result that even when we deal with human rights instruments, the OU has produced a convention on the rights of the African child, which indigenizes the rights of children. But we pay more focus on the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Children. The AU has produced the Charter on Women and People's Rights. It is not taken seriously. And the International Court of International Commission of Jurists talk about the rule of law in the African context. But we are only told about the rule of law. So I think that we need a serious transformation of the legal system, including an indigenization of the legal system. So we hope that from now going on, we should really talk about substantive transformation, which I think is the legislative problem. The department, with respect to Minister, has not produced any legislative program. When we look for this term and the coming term, there's only one bill that is there. And it is a bill that addresses the first world. There's no bill that addresses the concerns of the majority of the people. For instance, racism has reared its ugly head. And there were calls by parliament, by civil society, that we must criminalize racism. But what we hear from the department is that there is a bill somewhere to deal with hate speech. With respect, my view is that hate speech is a symptom of racism. It's not racism. What we need to deal with is racism, not symptoms of racism. We have the question of traditional courts. We were told that it will be introduced by November last year. And this year we are told that there is a reference group. Even today, we have not seen the outcome of that reference group. And at the end of the day, the modern criminal system does not reach the rural areas. Because when you are in the rural areas, you will be told that the police vehicle is broken and people queue at courts to deal with matters that can be properly dealt with by traditional courts. And Minister, we want to appeal to you to ensure that that bill was already before Parliament. It must come back to Parliament in whatever form. It is the parliamentarians anyway that their job to deal with legislation. We will deal with that. And the legal practice bill, I'm not sure if we should not revisit it and if necessary amend it, because we cannot allow practicing lawyers to determine the pace of change which would bring justice to the majority of the people. They are guarding their interests, they are not protecting the public interest. I think if we can't speed up the paralegal legislation because lawyers are holding it back, then we need to amend that law to make sure that we are free to address the concerns of our people. The question of the state attorney's office, I think with the Justice College, we can really get unemployed graduates, there are thousands of them, train them to become advocates. It's not very difficult to make a lawyer out of a person. But we can rely on this state attorney's office because people claim that the briefs are given to selected people, there's discrimination there. Now, I'm sure you are aware, Minister, that there is an alternative black bar. At a time when we say we want to create one legal system, we want to create a non-racial society, black lawyers feel discriminated in the existing bars. They are pulling out to form their own bars, which is an indication that there are serious problems. But lastly, Minister, let me say that you know, if there's something that can bring down this country, is the land question. The land claims court is not functioning well. The land claims court is not functioning well. We are informed that even the judges are not permanent, and on a sensitive matter that land, you find that the majority of the judges are white judges. I don't say that white judges don't have a sense of justice, but you see, justice must be seen to be done. Ordinary people in the rural areas, when they appear before white judges on land questions, and they see white lawyers there, they're not going to believe that justice will be done. And there's also information that government is losing cases in that court. So, Minister, we want to appeal to you to address the situation of the land claims court agency. And the President said that the Land Claims Restitution Act is loaded against the land claimants. Why should we not amend the law? Because if the law is in favor of one, there can't be justice, or justice cannot be simply done. What stops us to bring the necessary changes? So I think as Parliament, we also have the ability and the capacity to initiate laws. Maybe we should assist you by initiating other laws like the criminalization of racism. We can go to the next year without having a bill on that. The amendment of the Land Claims Court, we need amendments immediately. I think we can't stand any longer. We appreciate, Minister, that you have two big departments, and that's why we expect that your deputies should help you. The Deputy for Correctional Services, we've never seen him here, and we don't know why. So that we think we are even becoming unfair to you. The reason that we have two deputies is because they must assist you. So we want to know, maybe at some stage, why, what is the difficulties of your other deputy, because we don't see him. Lastly, on corrections, I think we really need a comprehensive plan showing how you are dealing with these problems of rehabilitation, social integration, what institutions have you established, like halfway houses, rehabilitation centers. You talk about partnerships with communities. I think we need to be taken to one of those implementation types of those partnerships so that we can see for ourselves. But I also lastly want to say, Minister, I don't think that with due respect to the arrangement in the executive, I don't think that you should depend on the Minister of Public Affairs, because your vision of what should be done in terms of you know, skills development and the projects IOA department makes much more sense, and we want to support that. I think we would urge you to talk to your colleague. If he doesn't cooperate, appeal to the president for intervention, because we can no longer wait more than we have waited. We want solutions now, tangible solutions. So thank you very much for a comprehensive input, Minister. Honorable Member, can we take the names? Honorable Hon, Honorable Nkumulwana, Honorable Maila, Honorable Bongo, Honorable Majapa. Honorable Hon.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, given the time constraints and as the Minister rightly indicated, some briefings we will receive will probably be better positioned to give us answers as to the ADPs and budget specifically. I will determine only myself to ask two questions in terms of a political overview. The first question is that the Minister indicated after the Supreme Court of Appeals judgment in the al-Bashir case that the government is contemplating appealing that decision to the Constitutional Court, but we've not been informed yet as to whether a decision was taken and whether the Minister now accepts the judgment of the Supreme Court of Appeal as the correct legal position, and if so, then what the Minister is going to do henceforth to rectify the illegal action on behalf of the government. And then secondly, Chair, in respect of the position of the Chapter 9 institutions, and specifically the public protector, and whilst I think we have appreciation for the fact that the Minister himself has over the past years refrained from entering into the whole debate regarding the powers of the public protector, quite possibly was because he was the chair of the committee that ultimately recommended her appointment a few years ago. The fact is that in the ministry, specifically from the deputy minister, there was a strong argument made out that she was constantly overstepping her authority. And now that the Constitutional Court has clarified the legal position, the question begs what the Ministry will do to, first of all, normalize the relationship with the current public protector, because obviously it can't be left just in the air, given what was said about her personally by the Deputy Minister. And then second of all, given the fact that over years now there's been a constant plea from her for additional budgetary provision, and that we now know the vitally important role in our constitutional order and in the justice cluster her office, not she personally, is to play going forward, will there be a fresh thinking about budgetary provision to the Office of the Public Protector? Thank you.
Minister, I just want to, first of all, congratulate you on various improvements on certain things, particularly on the question of the language in court, African language. I want to find out when are we likely to start with that. Secondly, I want to find out, I understand there is an overlapping in the work of various Chapter 9 institutions. They are doing the same investigations here, you find the public protector taking what the human rights is doing and so on. When are they likely to know that so and so must do this only, and this one is so and so. Thirdly, I want to find out on the question of, first of all, let me tell you that the tender system is, you're trying to make it, at least so that the people, the departments are able to do the work themselves. And the fact that, particularly in the correctional services, they are likely to revive the things like doing their own thing, I'm not happy with the... I think within the system they've got some problems and that lead to corruption. And I think there are quite a number of things that attract people. And because you promise that, and you promise that, lead us not into temptation. Thirdly, unfortunately, I just want to find out what do you discuss with other departments, with other friends? No, I think about the ones that lead to temptation. No, I was saying that the tender system. Yes. Now I'm going to say, how far do you discuss with other departments that are generally related to the work that you do? For example, the DTI, I mean, and the police, regarding the target, for example, which are major, they contribute a lot towards crime, and how far. There is a rule, for example, in the or law, in the issuing of licenses of taverns, that no tavern will be next to a church or school, or, you know, but there are quite a number of them around churches and then around schools, and there's not, nobody does anything about it. And that you've got a lot of, how do you discuss with other departments such that you limit the number of people indirectly coming to you to court and correction of service. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks, Minister, for the presentation. Chairperson, just two issues. One, just as a matter of emphasis, is one that you mentioned on the issue of the integrated justice system. As you are rightfully saying, I'm also concerned that this seems to be quite a story which reaches no logical conclusion. And I would like to see us moving in that field. The second issue is on the issue of overcrowding. And how we at times, regarding overcrowding, we put the Department of Correctional Services between a rock and a hard surface. On the one hand, we agree that overcrowding is not a problem peculiar to corrections, but it is a blaster problem. On the other hand, we always lambast corrections that they seem to put much of their budget on incarceration as opposed to other programs. But I don't see how other partners seem to be getting into the picture with regard to resolving the issue of overcrowding. So I would like to see various partners doing their duty with regard to that effect. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Minister, for the political overview. I think I need to say this, that just judging from the previous financial year till now, there are quite a lot of improvements in terms of the work of the department. But I think the summary that the chairperson has put is what generally as a committee we are concerned about. But seeing this with the three votes in the political overview, I think we are moving on the right path. And with regard to corrections in particular, I think there is now certainty since there was the appointment of the new commission and the CFO. And the Auditor General heard this last time that this financial year there may be improvements around the issues of courts. But one issue that I think we must just deal with and approach it is the whole reconfiguration of the structure at the correctional service. because these provinces are too vast. If we were to talk about the Mpumalanga Northwest and Limpopo, it's very difficult to manage. So I think if we were to look at the structure and configure it such that we are able to manage things properly. On the issue of the NCS, I think one method that you must be able to elevate, because we took a legal opinion on the matter. I think the sooner we are able to deal with it, it will be better. But one matter also I think that you must think critical about is the issue of the OSD and the extent to which it's limiting the way government departments works. Because it's like there's a problem around this issue of the OSD across the board from all other departments. So we may have to look at it. I think those would be my comments. But overall, I think despite the good job done by the three votes, I'm quite satisfied about all the improvements. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. To thank the Minister for the report and to say that it's quite important to notice the progress that has actually been made, especially by Justice, about improvement of their audits, because lately they have actually received qualified reports working towards clean audits, and we are hoping that they actually continue along those lines. And of course, with correctional services, we still worried about the qualified audits, and we are hoping that we'll see improvement. What is important is that we note the measures that have actually been put in place to try and deal with all of these challenges. We're just hoping that these measures will actually work. And going back to Justice about the third-party funds, we're just hoping that in the next report we'll find that there is a little bit of progress when it comes to third-party funds, which is one area that was actually lacking. The issue of IJS, we have been talking about it for quite some time. Which point, Minister? Third party funds, because there is the legislation that we have just developed to help us to manage to take care of third party funds, which has been a sore point in the Department of Justice. So we're just hoping that this will actually then help to deal with the historic mess that the department had to deal to handle, which was quite impossible because it's something that comes way back during our apartheid era, that were quite messy in terms of receiving funds and really accounting for these funds, the third party funds. But now we've developed new legislation that's supposed to really help us to address this area of work. We're hopeful that it will then manage their finances to be, to manage to get a clean audit in that regard. Okay, I wanted to come to IJS to say we've been talking about IJS for quite some time, but one has a feeling that it's not moving. And it's a very crucial aspect of the work that is actually being done around justice. Because if there's no connectedness, then it doesn't make sense. And then it's not quite effective. It takes a lot of time. So our wish is to see IJS really getting full attention. For if one day as you're sitting in this room, you say, we are clearly and well connected. When it comes to justice issues and correctional issues in South Africa. Because that will help us even to manage, because remember South Africa is has a huge challenge of crime. We have various forms of crime. I'm not even going to start labeling the crime. Except drug addiction also. It's one thing that is destroying our children. I was listening to a lady on SBSM yesterday afternoon when I was driving from my deployment. And just literally crying. She's done everything that is possible to try and deal with the drug addiction that is affecting her child and even trying to help the community in Lesia and Johannesburg. And the problem can't get away. It can't go away. And it's a challenge for us in South Africa. we have to come to a situation where we actually wage war against drugs. And in fact, the whole situation of drugs connected to stealing metal. Now we are all, the whole South Africa is going to have plastic tips, plastic pipes, because anything that is metal and copper is stolen. Another important dimension that we have actually also noted is that during the, when we were doing the amendment of the Criminal Procedure Act, there was a submission that talks about certain provinces managing to export copper when they don't have copper. And you want to know where the copper comes from. If we are losing copper, there's a lot of cable theft. We're losing a lot of copper in South Africa. If provinces, there are provinces that don't mine copper, but they manage to export from South Africa copper, that requires full investigation by the country. Another area that is a sore point is that in our quest to promote protection of human rights, a number of institutions in South Africa have actually also come up with a mechanism of coming with ombudsmen. One area that I want to mention where there appears to be a lot of complaint about ombudsman insurances, that people feel that when the letters are taken to insurance ombudsman, their letters are not actually handled satisfactorily. And what people complain about is that the ombudsmen are actually paid by the same industry. So now when you go and look for help from the same industry that you are complaining about, it's serious about really giving our people all forms of liberties. It's an area that we need to focus on about all this, because it creates false hope. You know, when you take an insurance policy and they tell you if anything goes wrong, you must know you've got an ambulance. But at the time you're supposed to get safe, it's then that you start realizing that this is not right. We need to start looking at that. When it comes to HR in both the departments, my one other concern would be to look at appointment of women so that there is balance. Something that is crucial, and at some point we have to make an audit to see to what extent is the department in terms of its employment policies representative of women. And we continue to, and I'm saying we because now I'm as if I have a head of a union sector. The union sector wants to see harsh sentences for violation of the rights of women, the murders of women, the rapes of women, even of children. We have to actually have harsher sentences. The issue of the state litigation account that is being, I think it's a shame for South Africans to want to make business by almost bankrupting governments. And something needs to be, something drastic needs to be done to really stop this, because you cannot actually beat, right, or destroy the hand that feeds you. We are running a country, but there are certain sectors of the country that feel that they want to make money out of government. I don't think it's being patriotic. It's something that needs to be fought vehemently. Thank you, Captain.
Minister, you have about 15 minutes. So what we're going to do, because this is not of your making, would request that the other responses be sent in writing, so you can just give a very broad response and then request that the other issues be submitted in writing.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to colleagues for a vibrant engagement. I think it's through that we can hand in hand work towards a common goal of making South Africa better overall. A number of issues have been raised on a number of occasions which reflects the extent of the concern in those specific areas. Quite deservedly so. I'm not going to here and now pretend that all of these things realistically are going to be achieved and to the extent that we all hope for in the shortest space of time in every instance. But I can say that genuine efforts are underway to truly turn around the situation. But it would be best, Chair, more than just giving written responses, to really have a dedicated session with relevant line functions in the department under the leadership of the accounting officer, respective accounting officer, to really drill deeper into concretely what are the things that are happening. We talk of community projects. I'll concede here and now in the front. First of the Commissioner for Corrections, for example, that I myself still need to see real shifts in our budgetary allocation in pursuit of some of our priority areas that we have identified as, if you like, flagship areas that we believe can turn around the situation in a significant way. but with a limited time, maybe let me dispose of some of the quick ones. Honorable Juan, and apologies for not following the sequence as the questions came. I cannot recall the time frame or the timeline of having to note an appeal if we so choose in the present LBE matter from the SCA to the Concord CEs. Probably what the officials may have already done or are planning to do is to tentatively note an application for leave to appeal just to beat the deadline. There was one cabinet meeting literally a few days after the judgment, so there hasn't been a sitting of cabinet to consider a way forward. You'd recall that in the Al-Bashir matter, there were no less than 13 respondents on the government side. Ourselves as the first respondent, naturally, because we administer that law. The judgment points to the fact that we have a blush assistant here, and we're going to have to confront that issue head on. We have a system of diplomacy that has existed, that predates history over 1,000 years, which was intended to organize the world politically in a manner that leaders of nations can visit each other, can send legates to really engage in matters that would ensure peace in the world, that would ensure mutual cooperation for trade and other objectives, for the overall improvement of the lot of their community, society. We are found in 2001, formalized South Africa's not only the recognition of that system of international law, but domesticated it and created a very detailed mechanism to facilitate DERCO's management of the according of diplomatic immunity in various contexts, including where South Africa hosts international meetings and so on. And of course, 3 months later, we passed another rule that seems, according to the court, to have basically nullified all of that in the face of situations where people may be facing criminal charges relating to measures that were in the Rome Statute, issues of genocide and related matters. So we need to, as a country, eventually decide what do we do given that impasse. And hopefully cabinet will assist with this matter and take an appropriate judgment call as to